So the title of my talk is looking at the transition of phosphorus sinks to phosphorus sources, and I'm going to talk about the impact that conservation practices may have on some of these mobilisations of phosphorus from legacy pea stores. And I just want to acknowledge my co-authors, Dr. Andrew Sharpley from the University of Arkansas, and Helen Jarvie, Dr. Helen Jarvie from the Centre for Ecology and Hydrology in the UK. So within the agricultural landscape and a watershed in an agricultural land use, we might consider there to be three main stores of terrestrial phosphorus and stream bed sediments. So also, firstly, we have the field soils and long-term application of phosphorus, especially manures, leads to a build-up of phosphorus in these soils, which can later be released to water. And many studies have shown that the decrease in soil P with crop offtake is very slow, even when phosphorus is reduced, inputs are reduced or even halted, and they can release environmentally significant concentrations of P for long periods of time. But there's also growing evidence that our land management practices, and in particular conservation practices, may actually change the speciation of phosphorus in these stores and may lead to differences in the mobilisation and could actually increase our release of phosphorus. Can also consider riparian zones to be a store of phosphorus, especially if a widely adopted strategy of application buffers and grass and vegetative buffers or wetlands are put in place, which are aimed to trap phosphorus at the edge of the field before it reaches the watercourse and could lead to an accumulation of phosphorus in these riparian areas. And then, as we've seen in these presentations, the stream bed sediments can also be a source of phosphorus and a store of phosphorus, and they take up phosphorus from the watercourse, from the overlying water, through sorption onto stream bed sediments and deposition of particulate pea and incorporation into the plant and microbial biota. And then these can be released at a later date. So as we've seen, all of these stores could eventually release pea. And I'm going to focus on field soils and riparian zones and give an overview of some literature reviews we've done looking at the impact of conservation practices on these, and some examples where both field soils and riparian zones may act as sources of phosphorus to the watercourse. So this table provides an overview of some of the main practices, conservation practices promoted by the USDA and NCRS, and the values show the effectiveness of these strategies based on a large number of field trials across the US, and the effect of the reduction in particulate pea and dissolved pea. And as you can see, for dissolved pea, there were only really two strategies which were consistently effective, the ones looking at source management, so the farm inputs and the nutrient management. And we have a lot more strategies targeting particulate pea, either through trapping phosphorus within the landscape before it reaches the watercourse, like buffer strips and conservation cover, or through controlling their transport, for example, with conservation tillage reducing erosion. But also you can see that these strategies are effective for particulate pea. For dissolved pea, in some cases, they're actually becoming sources of dissolved pea and increasing our loss of dissolved pea, which may explain why we're getting little effect of the implementation of these strategies on water quality in stream. And we also need to consider the adoption. So in a study by Osmond et al, reviewing a lot of the adoption practices of these large-scale conservation schemes, things like conservation tillage and buffer strips were quite well adopted, and most strategies seem to target particulate pea. However, while nutrient management was a cornerstone of most conservation schemes, that actually was relatively low adoption, and they found that even when nutrient management plans were in place, they often weren't fully implemented unless very considerable extension and outreach was provided. And this was probably partly due to the farmers not really trusting the recommendations, and also that they're more accepting of problems that they can visualise, like sediment loss, than dissolved nutrients. So we're just going to look at field soils and how conservation practices may affect these. At the moment, there's a big drive by NCRS to improve soil health through their soil health initiative, with four main principles: keeping the soil covered through the use of cover crops, for example, minimising soil disturbance, maybe through no-till, growing plants throughout the year, and diversifying crop species, with the overall goal of building soil organic matter to support a rich and diverse biological community. However, this will also have impacts on soil P, and we reviewed a number of the conservation practice field trials of a number of these conservation practices, for example, conservation tillage, the use of residue management, and the use of more manures as integrated nutrient management, and found that these increased the soil organic matter, but it was accompanied by a 3 to 180% increase in the soil organic P and a 30 to 240% increase in our microbial P pools. And there's growing recognition that these pools of phosphorus can contribute both to soil fertility and plant uptake, but also to loss to water. And they're not really very well accounted for in soil testing. So if we follow our soil test recommendations and don't account for these, then we're likely to be putting on more fertiliser than is really required, and may explain why there have been a number of studies where there's been no real yield improvements following the application of the recommended fertiliser doses. And also, these stores of soil organic phosphorus may become significant legacy P sources. So one example of one of these strategies is conservation tillage, and this data is taken from a study by Sharpley and Smith in 1994, where they looked at the implementation of conservation tillage on a wheat crop and found that it reduced erosion, as you'd expect, and that there was a large reduction in total P when you converted to no-till. However, when you looked at the dissolved P concentrations, conversion to no-till really significantly increased your dissolved P losses. And as this is obviously the most bioavailable pool, this could be significant for water quality. And when we look back at our table, we can see for particulate P, generally it was very effective, while for dissolved P, there was always an increase in losses, and this could be really significant. So coming on to our second store, so riparian soils, grass buffers and vegetated buffers are widely adopted conservation practice across many agricultural fields, and these work by slowing the flow of runoff, increasing deposition of particulates and absorption of phosphorus onto the soils before it reaches the water course. However, over time, this may lead to a build-up of phosphorus in these areas. So going back to the table, as we can see, it was very effective for particulate P, but variable for dissolved P, and could lead to large increases in P loss. And various studies have also shown that the build-up of labile P stores in these grass buffer strips compared to the field soils, and that microbial processes are really key in mediating the P release, and it's not just saturation of the P absorption capacity. So we've just finished a trial on a hog farm down in Arkansas, where we looked at the speciation of phosphorus in soils across three zones: the field soils which received swine manure, a grass application buffer where no manure was applied, and an unmanaged riparian zone. And we took soils across transects through these zones across four seasons, and measured some soil chemical properties, including water extractable P, total P, and for both of these we looked at the inorganic and the organic fraction, and the Malic tree P, iron and aluminium, and then also looked at some biological parameters, microbial biomass, phosphorus with nitrogen and carbon, and some phosphatase activities. And this is just some very preliminary data. So we could see, as you may expect, that the Malic tree concentration decreased quite substantially between the field soil, the grass buffer, and into the riparian zone. However, when we looked at the inorganic water extractable P, so the orthophosphate, there was a reduction between the field soil and the riparian zone, but it was much less than for the Malic extractable P, which was about 70%, and for water extractable P, it was about 40%. And then when we looked at the total water extractable P following digestion of the extract, there was actually no significant difference between the field soils and the riparian zones, despite the large difference in Malic extractable P. And when you took the inorganic away from the total to give us the organic water extractable P, we found that these riparian zones, there was a large contribution of organic P pools to the water extractable P concentration, and highlights the importance of these dissolved organic P forms, particularly in these areas, and these may be significant for a water quality perspective as well as the inorganic forms. So we carried out some regression analysis just to look at which of these factors may be contributing to the water extractable P. So the total water extractable P, when we included mainly the soil chemical properties, stepwise regression suggested that phosphorus, iron and aluminium Malic tree should be included, which would give us an R squared of 0.66. However, the regression also suggested that if we added in the microbial biomass carbon and nitrogen and phosphomonoesterase activity, it was a much better model, and the R squared increased to 0.74. Similarly, for the inorganic water extractable P fraction, Malic, phosphorus, iron and aluminium would give us an R squared of around 0.62. But the stepwise regression suggested we should add in microbial biomass carbon and nitrogen and the phosphomonoesterase activity, which would slightly increase our R squared. But when we looked at the organic water extractable P, only the Malic P and aluminium seemed to be contributing, and the R squared was not really that great, only 0.34. The addition of soil organic phosphorus increased that slightly, but the model suggested we should include the microbial biomass nitrogen and the phosphodiesterase activity, which would increase the R squared to 0.55. So all of this suggests to us that the soil test P alone is not really that representative of the potential release to water, especially if you have large stores of organic P, and that soil organic phosphorus and microbial processes are contributing to both the inorganic and the organic water extractable P fractions and need to be considered when looking at the potential for P release. So just finally, I want to think about what this all means for designing our conservation practices and our conservation schemes. Firstly, we need to select the conservation practice based on pollutant form, and I think there needs to be much more focus on dissolved P and strategies which can reduce our dissolved P losses. We also need to recognise that certain practices, particularly those which trap phosphorus within the landscape, could create sources of P in the future, since we're accumulating it, especially in riparian zones, which are next to the stream, so are likely to be critical source areas. We also need to recognise that soil organic P can contribute both to our soil fertility and to our potential for phosphorus loss, and we need to have better methods to incorporate this into our soil testing regimes to make sure that it's accounted for properly when we consider our fertiliser recommendations. And finally, I think we need to make sure that our monitoring schemes don't just look at orthophosphate, but also look at some of the dissolved forms, which may be significant and can contribute to water quality and problems. So thank you for your attention, and I'll take any questions.